Well, turn with me, please, to the book of Genesis and chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2, and I'm just going to read the first three verses. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Now, I said a few weeks ago that even at a purely literary level, before you even get into its actual content, Genesis chapter 1 is a remarkable composition. It's a highly sophisticated piece of writing. And one device, one technique that is very prominent throughout the passage is the use of repetition. Many of us could probably very easily, just off the top of our heads, reel off most of the main verbs that are used in Genesis chapter 1. God said, God saw, God made, God called, God blessed, God created, and so on. And the reason then that it's so easy for us to, as I say, reel off those verbs is because none of them is used just once. Each of them, to some degree at least, is repeated. Repetition, I'm saying, is a major feature of Genesis chapter 1. And that means, therefore, that it's very noticeable when in the verses that I've read just now, and by the way, we should really consider these verses as part of Genesis chapter 1. The chapter break here is fairly arbitrary and unhelpful. It's very noticeable, I say, when in these verses that I've just read, Moses throws in a new verb. And not only is it a new verb, but it's a very different kind of verb, very different to the verbs that he has been using in the preceding verses. A verb that you wouldn't really expect, probably. A verb, indeed, which you might even feel a bit uncomfortable about using in connection with God in the way that Moses does here. Which verb am I referring to? Well, it's there in verse 2. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he'd been doing, so on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. That's the verb to which I'm referring. God rested. Now, I think that to some extent, we find ourselves here in a similar situation to that in which we found ourselves last time when we were considering man made in the image of God. You remember that we said on that occasion that it's very difficult to really put too much biblical content into that concept, the concept of man made in the image of God. It's very difficult to identify from the Bible exactly what the divine likeness in human beings actually is. And similarly here, it's very difficult, I think, to put any biblical content into this concept of God resting. It's very difficult to identify from the Bible exactly what is involved in this idea of divine rest. I suppose that there are three things which we can say for definite, although even two of those are negative rather than positive. The first thing we can say for definite is that this rest does not imply fatigue. It does not imply fatigue. We're not to think here that God is exhausted, that having created the heavens and the earth, God is worn out. His energy has been completely drained so that all he can do is crash out and recharge the batteries and recuperate from all that he has exerted over these 6 days. That is not what we are to think here. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28. God's energy is literally infinite. You can't make inroads into it. It cannot be diminished. Had God made a million universes like this one, even in a single day, let alone in a single week, he would have been none the worse for it. This rest here, which God enters into, does not imply fatigue on the part of the Maker. Second thing we can say for definite, this rest is permanent. This rest is permanent. Now, I'm not getting that from Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 to 3, but I'm getting it from the other passage which I read earlier on, Hebrews chapter 4, and we'll be returning to this passage again later on. But suffice to say just now that in the second half of verse 3, the writer says that his work, that is God's work, has been finished since the creation of the world. And the writer is saying then that from this point here in Genesis chapter 2, from this point, God has been at rest. This wasn't a brief breather that God had here. But and we mustn't think that having kind of taken a little breather, he then picked up tools and continued creating. That's not the picture. This was a permanent rest into which God entered, a rest that would be abiding, a rest that would be ongoing. Third thing we can say for definite, this rest doesn't involve inactivity. It doesn't involve inactivity. We sang a few moments ago, didn't we, from the second half of Psalm 65, and that part of the psalm then, as I said, has a distinctly harvest theme to it. And what's particularly remarkable about it, as I commented, I think, in prayer, is the extent to which the psalmist sees God as being involved, heavily involved in the production of crops. And so at the beginning then of verse 9, you tend the land and water it. And then in verse 10, you drench the furrows of the land. You level off the ground. You soften it with showers of rain and make its crops abound. Now, if you just took that verse on its own, out of its context, you would think the psalmist was describing a farmer, wouldn't you? A farmer kind of irrigating the crops. A farmer leveling off the ground. But he's not describing a farmer. He is describing the activity of God. And you find similar language in Psalm 104 and again in Psalm 147. This picture of an involved and active and hands-on kind of God. And so we're not to think then that having created the heavens and the earth, here now, at the beginning of Genesis chapter 2, God, as it were, winds up all the complex mechanisms of this universe he has just made. He sets it all going and then kind of lounges back in an armchair and watches it all ticking over by itself. That's not the picture. My Father, Jesus said, John 5 verse 17, my Father is always working. And so that's the third thing that we can say for definite then, that this rest does not involve inactivity. Well, if those then are three things that we can say for definite and which take us then a certain distance, there's something else which we can say, I think, with a fair degree of confidence, if not with absolute certainty, and it's this, that God has been and continues to be at rest in the specific sense that he is satisfied with his finished work of creation. Now, we must insist, of course, that it is part of the essence of God's being that as Paul puts it in 1 Timothy 1 verse 11, he is the blessed God. God, in other words, is never agitated. God is never unfulfilled. He is the blessed God. And he was the blessed God, therefore, at every single point throughout the process of creating the heavens and the earth. We must, as I say, insist upon that. But we must also admit, surely, that God couldn't view the creation at the end of the first day, for instance, or at the end of the fourth day, or at the end of the fifth day, in quite the same way that he could view it at the end of the sixth day. Because only at that point did he see it as complete. Only at that point did he see it as perfectly conforming to his original blueprints. And so at that point, he didn't crash out and recharge his batteries, because as we've already said, that was unnecessary. And at that point, he didn't sink back into an armchair and just watch the whole thing tick over by itself, because that, as we've already said, is inconsistent with the entire biblical picture of God's relationship to the universe. But at that point, he did derive enjoyment from and satisfaction in this finished work, this finished creation, this creation that he had now completed all the bits of. And in that sense then, in that specific sense, God rested. And it seems to me that two major implications flow from this concept of God's rest. And I want to look at those now for the remainder of our time. The first major implication then that flows from this satisfied rest, as we might describe it, of God, is this. It is the basis of the Bible's entire story. It's the basis of the Bible's entire story. Now that might surprise you somewhat. But I want to suggest this morning that the one story which the Bible is telling all the way from Genesis to Revelation is the story of human beings sharing God's rest with him. You think, first of all, of Genesis 1 and 2. And admittedly, the language of rest isn't actually used there in connection with human beings, in connection with Adam and Eve. But is it not the case that that word rest is a very fitting description, isn't it, of Adam and Eve's existence there in Genesis 1 and 2? They enjoyed rest. Rest, again, then, not in the sense of idleness, of inactivity, but rest in this specific sense of satisfaction. They were satisfied people in Genesis 1 and 2. They were satisfied with their environments. Chapter 2 and verse 9, it was pleasing to the eye. They were satisfied with themselves. Chapter 2 verse 25, the man and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame. And they were satisfied supremely with their and in their relationship with God. We find out later in chapter 3 and verse 8 that God habitually walked in the garden with them, that he communed with them in the Garden of Eden. And so I'm saying then that in Genesis 1 and 2, Adam and Eve were satisfied, comprehensively satisfied people. And in that sense then, they shared God's rest with him. But all that changed, of course, in Genesis chapter 3 as a result of their disobedience, as a result of their rebellion against God. And suddenly, the rest has gone, hasn't it? Suddenly, the rest has disappeared. Suddenly, they don't have that satisfaction which formerly they had. They no longer derive satisfaction from their environment. Now it produces thorns and thistles and results in painful toil. Chapter 3, verses 17 and 18. They no longer derive satisfaction from themselves. Now they cover themselves with fig leaves sewed together. Chapter 3, verse 7. And now they no longer derive satisfaction in their relationship with God. Now they hide from Him among the trees. Chapter 3, and verse 8. They are no longer satisfied people, and no longer, therefore, do they share God's rest with Him. But that, of course, is not the end of the story. Indeed, the story has barely begun. And I want to suggest to you that the rest of the Bible story is effectively the story of God in astonishing and almost incredible grace toward an utterly undeserving race, re-offering His rest to human beings. Throughout the remainder of the Old Testament, He does this primarily in a pictorial fashion. And the main picture that He uses then is the promised land, the land of Canaan. And so on at least three places in the book of Deuteronomy, for instance, in chapter 3, verse 20, in chapter 12, verse 10, and in chapter 25, verse 19, God speaks of giving His Old Testament people, the Israelites, rest. And if you look up those references, it's very obvious that He's referring specifically to the way in which He is going to take this homeless, nomadic people of Israel, and He is going to settle them in the land of Canaan, in the promised land. He's going to settle them there in safety and in security. And then again, when you come to Psalm 95, and you have there the psalmist talking in verse 11 of God, of that generation of Israelites about whom God said, "I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest." Again, it's very obvious that the rest that the psalmist is talking about is the land of Canaan. It was the land of Canaan. It was entry there that this generation of disobedient Israelites was specifically denied. So I'm saying then that in the Old Testament, this rest which God, the God of grace, is re-offering to sinful human beings, this rest in the Old Testament is pictured in the promised land, the land of Canaan. But then when we come into the New Testament, it becomes very clear that Canaan was only a picture. That's particularly clear then in the passage that we read earlier on in Hebrews chapter 4. And we read then in verse 8 of Hebrews chapter 4, if Joshua, of course, was the one who finally did lead the Israelites into the land of Canaan. If Joshua had given them rest, in other words, if Joshua, by leading the people into Canaan, had given them that full and final rest which God, from Genesis 3 onwards, is offering to human beings, if Joshua had given them that, then God would not have spoken later about another day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. So the writer is saying then that that rest into which Joshua led the people of Israel, it was only a picture. It wasn't the full and final rest which God is offering sinful human beings. And a couple of other things become very clear in the New Testament as well. One thing that becomes clear is that this rest is supremely experienced beyond the grave. This rest which God is graciously offering human beings is supremely experienced beyond the grave. And so you have Some fairly well-known words in Revelation chapter 14, verse 13. John writes, "Then I heard a voice from heaven say, 'Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on.' Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labor, for their deeds will follow them." And the other thing that becomes very clear in the New Testament is that this rest which God is graciously offering human beings is offered very specifically through Jesus Christ. For it is he, of course, who in Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, stands up and shouts out to all the listening crowds, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." And so I'm saying then that this concept of human beings sharing God's rest is basically the story of the Bible. It was there at the start in Genesis 1 and 2. It was lost in Genesis 3, and it's reoffered throughout the rest of the Bible in pictorial fashion throughout the Old Testament, and then much more clearly when we enter into the New Testament. And it seems to me that this central storyline of the Bible could not be more relevant to this 21st century society, this 21st century Western society in which you and I live. Because if the word restless fittingly describes human beings generally this side of Genesis chapter 3, does it not in a very particular way fittingly describe our society that we live in today? This is a profoundly restless society. People around us are profoundly restless. It's manifested, isn't it, in the many workaholics that we're constantly being presented with. Those who are working 6 or 7 days a week, long hours. They come home late in the evening. Even then, they still have emails to write, phone calls to make. And they can't lay their work down. It's always on their mind. They wake up at night thinking about it. That's a manifestation of this restlessness. It's manifested too in the great problem of young people, particularly young women, being so unhappy with their own physical appearance as they are presented with unfeasibly beautiful women on the front of magazines and so on, and they feel they can never live up to that standard, and it causes them huge psychological and emotional problems. That's another manifestation, is it not, of this restlessness at the heart of our society. It's evident too in the rise of alcoholism and drug addiction, the way in which people seek escape routes, escape from reality in those things, or in compulsive gambling, or in computer games, or whatever it might be. This is a profoundly restless society. Perhaps you're part of that this morning. Perhaps you feel restless. And I'm saying to you this morning that if that's the case, the Bible's central story is hugely and massively relevant to you, because the Bible has good news. And the good news is this, that there is rest possible. There is satisfaction possible. Indeed, there is nothing less than God's own rest and God's own satisfaction possible. If you come by faith to Jesus Christ, if you come to him looking for rest and for satisfaction in him, then you will experience from him and through him God's own rest and God's own satisfaction. You will experience it to a great degree even now, even while you still live in this world. Even now, the removal of that sense that you have to work longer hours, or you have to look that bit more physically attractive, or you have to submit yourself to the influence of mind-bending drugs in order to find that elusive fulfillment that you so much crave. The removal of that sense of already being complete, already being fulfilled, already being enough in Jesus Christ. And supremely, you will experience that rest beyond the grave when Eden itself will be restored by Almighty God. And so I'm saying to you that if you know anything of that deep and ineradicable restlessness of which I'm speaking, which has been man's lot since Genesis 3, I'm saying that the answer to it is through Jesus Christ, the one who said, I will give you rest, through believing in him. Nothing less than the rest, the satisfied, fulfilled, blessed rest of God himself will be yours now and forevermore. And I'm saying then that the basis of all of that is here in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 2. Because it's here that this concept then of a resting God is first introduced to us. So that's the first thing. It's the first implication. It's the basis of the Bible's entire story. But then the second implication that flows from this concept of God's rest is this. It's the basis of the Sabbath day. It's the basis of the Sabbath day. Now, we must recognize immediately, of course, that these verses here in Genesis chapter 2 contain no explicit command concerning man's observance of the Sabbath. In order to find that, you have to look elsewhere in the Bible. But it seems to me that God does two things here in Genesis chapter 2, verse 3, both of which he does very specifically with an eye to, with a view to, man's observance of the Sabbath. And so let's consider those two things that God does in verse 3. First of all, he blesses the seventh day. He blesses the seventh day. Now this is the third place in this creation account in which we read of God blessing. In chapter 1, verse 22, he blesses the sea creatures and the birds. And in chapter 1, verse 28, he blesses man. And what's interesting and what's very important, I think, is that in both of those places, God's blessing precedes a command. In chapter 1, verse 22, we read, God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number. And then in verse 28 again, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. God's blessing then in both of those places in Genesis 1 is prior to and is accompanied by a command. You might almost put it like this, that in Genesis chapter 1 verse 22, God is filling the sea creatures and the birds of the air with reproductive potential, if you like. That's the blessing part of it. He's filling them with reproductive potential. And then he goes on to say, if you obey this command and if you mate, to put it bluntly, then that reproductive potential that I have bestowed upon you, birds and sea creatures, will be realized. And the bird population and the sea creature population will grow and grow and grow. And we have the same thing then in verse 28 of chapter 1. God there is, again then, filling human beings with reproductive potential. That's the blessing part of it. And he's then saying that if you obey my command and if you come together as husband and wife, as is going to become clear in the next chapter, in sexual union, then that reproductive potential that I have bestowed upon you, that blessing will be realized and the human population will grow and grow and grow. And so you see what I'm saying then, that there's the blessing which enables the thing to happen. And then there's the command, this is what you must do. And I think that we have the same thing here then in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 3. But the difference here is that there's a delay, there's a gap between the blessing and the command. The blessing is here in Genesis 2 verse 3. The command comes later on in Exodus 20 and in Deuteronomy 5. The fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy, or observe the Sabbath day in Deuteronomy's terminology. And so here in Genesis 2 then, God is filling this day, this one day in seven, with rest potential. He's filling it with the potential to really refresh and reinvigorate and rejuvenate human beings physically and mentally and in their general health and well-being. And then in Exodus 20 and in Deuteronomy 5 comes the command, if you obey this command, if you keep the Sabbath, then that rest potential that I have bestowed upon the day will be realized. And you will be refreshed. You will be rejuvenated. You will be reinvigorated physically and mentally and in your general health and well-being. And this still applies. This blessing upon the one day in seven has not been revoked. And still today, therefore, when human beings, and I'm talking about human beings generally, not Christians simply, but when human beings keep that command and observe the Sabbath, and I don't mean even by going to church and worshiping God, but even just at that most basic level of refraining from work, refraining from labor, when human beings do that, then the blessing that God bestowed upon the one day in seven here in Genesis 2 is realized in their experience. They will benefit. Human beings, whatever their religion, whatever their convictions, whether they be Christians or Muslims or Hindus or atheists, whatever they are, if they observe the Sabbath, if they set it apart, then they will experience the blessing that God bestows upon the one day in seven here. They won't be converted by doing so. It won't change their eternal destiny. But they will enjoy all the benefits of physical and mental refreshment and rejuvenation. And it will improve their health and their well-being. And again, is that not very relevant to our society today? Do we not live in a society that badly needs to recover this principle, this command of the one day in seven set apart as rest? I'm not always in the business of making connections between bad things that are going on in society around us and the rebellion of our society against God. So in other words, saying that this bad thing is happening because society is rebelling against God in this way. I think often those kind of connections have little biblical warrant and we must be very careful with them. But we can say this, that if our society did indeed observe the Sabbath, if our society did indeed refrain from its labor and from its work on the one day in seven, then it would bring a great deal of relief to the epidemic of stress and breakdown that is so rife all around us. This blessing that God has placed upon the one in seven has never been revoked, and our society is missing out on all that blessing by ignoring this command. So God blesses the seventh day. But then the other thing he does is this, he makes it holy. He makes it holy. Well, what then do we mean by that? Well, let's think about the Old Testament people of God, the Israelites. And they had holy days, didn't they? We read, for instance, in Nehemiah chapter 10. We don't need to go into the context, but it's basically just the people making a covenant with God. And in Nehemiah chapter 10, verse 31, they say to God, "When the neighboring peoples bring merchandise or grain to sell on the Sabbath, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or on any holy day." So the Israelites then had various holy days in their calendar. And what then for the Israelites was a holy day? Well, it was basically a day connected with a religious theme. So if it was the Passover, for instance, that was connected with the theme of redemption. It was the day in which they commemorated God bringing the Israelites out of Egypt. So that day was connected with the theme of redemption. Or if it was a day of atonement, obviously the religious theme connected with that day was atonement, was forgiveness of sins through the shedding of blood. And God then is here making the seventh day a holy day. In other words, he's making it a day that is connected with a religious or some religious themes. What religious themes? Well, I suppose that for Adam and Eve, there in Genesis 1 and 2, in the Garden of Eden, it was the theme of creation. So obviously, throughout their entire week, Adam and Eve were constantly aware that God had created. They couldn't forget that. As they saw the beauty and the wonder of the creation all around them, they were constantly aware that God was the creator, God had made it. But in a particular way, the seventh day, I think, brought to their attention the fact of creation, the fact that God was their creator. And so it had that religious theme for Adam and Eve, the theme of creation. But then, of course, as the Bible moves on and we go beyond the fall in Genesis 3 and we go beyond the Exodus, the redemption of Israel from bondage, the day takes on a new and additional religious theme. And so in Deuteronomy chapter 5 and that particular version of the Ten Commandments, we read there in verse 12, "Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy as the Lord your God has commanded you." And then it goes on in verse 15, "Remember that you were slaves in Egypt and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day." And so for those Israelites then, the day had taken on a new religious theme. It was a holy day now in this new additional sense that they remembered and commemorated the Exodus from Egypt. But I don't think it stops there. But as the Bible progresses further, and as we come to the New Testament, far from the one day in seven being annulled and being abandoned, as is sometimes suggested, it takes on additional significance. There's an additional religious theme connected now with the day, although it's still the theme of redemption. But now it's, of course, redemption in its full and final form in Jesus Christ and his death, and particularly his resurrection. That resurrection of Jesus, indeed, which was such a significant religious theme that it demanded the day even be moved from the seventh day to the first day. And so the one day in seven now, it still has the significance of creation. It still has the significance of redemption, but now redemption in its final form, redemption as located in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And indeed, I think there are other religious themes connected with this holy day, the one day in seven. There's the interesting fact, for instance, that you know how the Bible talks about, in both the Old Testament and the New Testament, the day of the Lord. Talking about the end of history, of course, the second coming, the day of the Lord. Well, grammatically, that is precisely the same phrase as the phrase we have in the New Testament, the new phrase for the one day in seven, the Lord's Day, the day of the Lord, the Lord's Day. It's exactly the same phrase grammatically. And I think that that's significant. It's saying that another religious theme which is connected with this holy day, the one day in seven, is the final coming of Christ, the end of all things. It's, this day speaks of that as well, not only of creation, not only of redemption, but of the end, the final end of history when Jesus Christ returns. And then, of course, there's the general religious theme of rest that we've already talked about in the first part of our sermon today. The day speaks of that as well, and particularly that rest which is offered in and through Jesus Christ. And so I'm saying then that these verses in Genesis 2, there's no explicit Sabbath command here. But what God does on this seventh day is with a view to man's observance of the Sabbath. For one thing, he blesses the day. He fills it with potential to really do men and women good if they will obey his command and keep it as a Sabbath. And then secondly, he makes it holy. He makes it a day, in other words, to be full of religious significance. A day which, every time it comes around, should speak to us very powerfully of certain themes. Themes which we're aware of in the other 6 days, but themes which we are really impressed by in a greater sense on this one day. The theme of creation, the theme of redemption through Christ's resurrection, the theme of the final coming of Christ, and the theme of rest. And so I want to encourage and exhort you to use the first day of the week, the Lord's Day, the Sunday of each week, to that end, to commemorate these themes, to really expose yourself in a way that you don't have the opportunity to do so throughout the rest of the week, to expose yourself to these grand themes of the Bible story. And this is a duty. It is a command. It's there as part of the abiding moral law of God. But it's a delight as well, as all God's duties, when approached properly through Christ, it's a delight. And it's to our immeasurable benefit if indeed we use the day to soak ourselves in these great themes of God's redemptive purposes. Amen.